From Arizona Public Media in Tucson, I'm Mark Dugan. Arizona turned 100 years old on February 14, 2012. Over the past century, the state's population has grown from about 200,000 to 6.4 million. The newcomers moved here for the sunshine and for the work, and they helped build the state's economy into a $261 billion machine. In the early days, the machine was fueled by mining and livestock and the railroads, but they were soon replaced by agriculture. And then the state's warm, dry climate gave rise to a health and resort industry. Soon, just five areas of commerce anchored Arizona's economy, so we gave them a catchy name.
The Five C's of Arizona.
And then we started teaching school children about how important they are.
Cattle, citrus, climate, copper, cotton.
But how important are they today? Do the Five C's still matter when orchards and cotton fields are being swallowed by development, and when even the tourism industry has found itself subject to the recession? We'll find out over the next half hour. This is the Five C's. A century later, an Arizona Public Media centennial special report. Along the way, we'll visit cattle ranches and an open-pit copper mine. We'll find out what it's like to grow lemons and cotton in the desert, and we'll learn how one C affects all the others. It's all ahead on the Five C's, a century later.
Cattle, citrus, climate, copper, cotton.
Of all of the Five C's, cattle may get the least attention. The livestock industry in Arizona is rarely in the news, but cattle ranches and feedlots are found in every county in the state. Ranchers in Arizona produce more than 380 million pounds of beef annually, and most are drawing on generations of family experience, as Steve Shadley found when he visited a few ranches near Tucson recently.
Joe King drives his oversized diesel pickup truck out of a Tucson hardware store parking lot. He's just dropped a pile of cash on supplies for his family's ranch located near Tucson in the rural community of Three Points.
My great-grandfather, Manuel King, came here from California and managed to pick up cattle and trade cattle and started his family, and we've been there since 1895.
For more than 100 years, King's family has raised cows for beef sold locally. As far back as the late 1600s, people began raising cattle along the Santa Cruz River in southern Arizona, and the tradition continues. Despite today's tough economy, Joe says he wants to hand the ranch over to his kids someday.
It's a lot of fun, but it can be a lot of work. We love it, and it's worth every chance we got at it.
State historian Lisa Schnebley-Heidinger says hard-nosed ranchers like the King family helped make Arizona what it is today.
They were probably, in some ways, the most established settlers. Everybody else really rotated through. At least they put down some roots along with their cattle.
While corporate livestock firms are becoming more common, here in Arizona, the family ranch can still compete with commercial producers. Arizona Farm Bureau President Kevin Rogers estimates family ranches contribute about $700 million to the state's economy each year. Despite the stubborn recession, he says a lot of family ranches are still alive, and the Arizona cowboy remains a symbol of the American West.
There's a certain romance about the guys that they get to ride the horses every day and push the cattle around and enjoy the beauty that God's created for us.
Well, howdy, boys and girls. Doggone, it's mighty neighborly of you to drop by and join us around the campfire. Well, I'm Roy Rogers, and the singing you hear is by Bob Nolan and the Sons of the Pioneers.
On this old record, Roy Rogers, King of the Cowboys, reminisces about life on the cattle trail in the Old West.
Oh, yes, and this is my horse Trigger. Well, sit down now and get comfortable while I stir up the fire.
Decades ago, a lot of cowboys around Arizona were the kind you'd find in the movies.
Hey, those coyotes sure sound mighty lonesome tonight.
Dude, that coyote's been around, like, for weeks.
Almost as if on cue in an old Western movie, a flea-bitten coyote runs uncomfortably close to Carol Ann Scott. She's standing in the middle of a dusty rodeo arena in the desert on the outskirts of Tucson. Carol Ann has been practicing her barrel racing moves for an upcoming rodeo. Carol Ann is from a family of ranchers, and she hopes to carry on in the business.
I'm always going to want beef, you know, and so the cattle industry, it's all going to stick around for a long time. You know, we're not going anywhere.
A horse gets a new set of shoes as nearby John Marcello loads up some calves into the back of his shiny new cattle trailer at a feedlot in Tucson.
They were hard to load. This little calf here, he's a hungry son.
Marcello is a self-described meat scientist at the University of Arizona. He's seen quite a few changes in the state's ranching industry over the years. Marcello says in the old territorial days, cowboys were worried about Indian raids. But after the Civil War, when the railroads arrived, profits soared, and there were some early problems with overgrazing. He says farmers, dairymen, and cattle ranchers strongly influenced the state's political scene up until about 50 years ago. But nowadays, he says more local growers are marketing their beef on the internet, and more are going organic.
A lot of the ranchers are merchandising their own product now as grass-fed, and they're going to the outdoor markets. So that has been lucrative to them. And of course, that's throughout the United States also.
Arizona's cattle industry continues to evolve with changes in the market. Now one of the more profitable trends is the Dude Ranch, with tourists from around the world coming to Arizona to get a taste of the Western ranch lifestyle.
That's reporter Steve Shadley, and I'm Mark Dugan. You're listening to The Five C's, A Century Later, an Arizona Public Media special report. When Arizona became a state in 1912, its farmers were already cultivating things like alfalfa, wheat, and vegetables. But cotton was particularly popular. Historian Tom Sheridan says our climate was perfect for growing long-staple cotton, which was used in industrial fabrics like tires.
The old cotton belt of the American South wasn't suitable because it was too humid. And so that's when the major tire companies like Goodyear and Dunlop triggered a boom in long staple cotton that was really astonishing.
Cotton acres are down. As a cotton farmer, I can tell you our acres have reduced some.
Kevin Rogers isn't just a cotton farmer. He's president of the Arizona Farm Bureau. He says even though the amount of land devoted to cotton farming is down, production is up because prices are up.
We're going through a stretch right now where it's a good time to be in the cotton business, and we're trying to find ways to sustain that as long as we can.
But Rogers is also a pragmatist. He knows that cotton, like other commodities, can go through wild price swings. So he'd better play it safe, even during the good times. That means putting off buying that new $500,000 cotton picker.
Some of us have been reluctant to jump out and buy the new machinery because the cotton market's up, because we know the cotton market's up now, but you know, 2 years from now, it could be back down to 70 cents a pound, and you really need closer to 80 cents to break even. And so those opportunities, when the market's up, you bank those for those years when it's down.
Ron Rayner is another of those cotton farmers, but he doesn't just grow it. He co-owns and manages a cotton gin near Buckeye, Arizona, and he pays close attention to where the cotton he grows ends up. He points to a tag on the side of a nearby cotton bale.
They'll both arrive at the cow warehouse at the same time. They'll get the bale.
He's explaining how he tracks each bale from the gin to the warehouse. Cotton farming, like everything else, has gone high tech.
See, the incoming moisture is about 6.4%, but it's got an automatic feature, so it'll adjust it.
Ron Rayner has just finished his cotton harvest and has already replanted his fields with durum wheat. Now he's spending a lot of time at the gin, where cotton lint is separated from seed, then cleaned and pressed into bales for shipping to a textile mill. Rayner is a third-generation cotton farmer. He grew up on the land he farms. Today, Rayner makes his living growing several different crops, which allows him to ride out some of the volatility of the cotton markets. But the industry seems to be losing ground, literally. And it's only partially because of development swallowing farmland. Another factor, these days, it's expensive to grow just about anything.
It takes a lot of infrastructure to handle the crop. And you think about it, it takes harvest equipment on the part of the growers and any specialized planting equipment and that sort of thing. But then the availability of cotton ginning equipment. We generally see that once a cotton gin is closed, the equipment is sold off to an underdeveloped country or sold for scrap, they'll usually never come back. This year even, we're seeing some facilities, the capabilities being taxed because all of a sudden there's an influx of cotton and the processing capacity had shrunk quite a bit. So now there's going to be some delays in getting the cotton gin because of just limits on harvest capacity.
Cotton gin's a gin, now the pen is for the pound. Like a giant vacuum cleaner sucking lean upon the ground.
Billy Joe Shaver accurately describing the sound of a cotton gin.
Jesus was our savior, cotton was our king.
You know, the role of a little processing facility like this in the economy, local economy. You know, we have seven guys on each shift, and, well, plus the manager. You can see the number of trucks and other things running around, and it's all part of the grand scheme of things that makes the economy go.
Agriculture is over a $10 billion business right now, and that's even larger than our copper industry.
Kevin Rogers.
Even though our acres of production is smaller, we're not quite as visible as we were 30 years ago, because 30, 40 years ago, everybody's grandpa did have a farm. Technology's allowed us to produce more on less acres.
Both Rogers and Rayner say they'll continue to farm cotton. After all, they have both the equipment and the knowledge. And if the current cotton boom goes bust, they can always adjust their growing mix.
But the question is it going to be 80% of your farmland, or is it going to be, you know, 30% of your farmland? And price is going to drive that. It's expensive to grow cotton here. In other parts of the country where they rely on rain, they don't have to spend that $200 an acre on water that we have to spend. And so that $200 an acre can put us out of the market depending on the retail price of cotton.
As of today, Arizona's cotton industry is thriving, even with less acreage under production. So it continues to be one of the state's major economic forces and a way of life for the farmers who grow it. Over the years, that fluffy white crop that goes into everything from tires to t-shirts.
It's been a good, successful business, but it's our cotton.
I'm in high cotton, popcorn's popping, there ain't no stopping me now.
This is the 5 C's, A Century Later, an Arizona Public Media special centennial report. I'm Mark Dugan. There's much more on our website. Just look for the 5 C's logo at azpublicmedia.org. If you could travel back in time to a century ago and visit what's now present-day Phoenix or Mesa, you'd see orange and lemon groves for miles and miles. Even 50 years ago, citrus was a major player in the state's economy, but production is way down today because of development, foreign competition, and the recession. Growers have had to branch out into niche markets just to stay alive. One of them is Dwayne Justice, whose 300-acre orchard is surrounded by the city. But all those new homes and businesses have also created a new market for him. Fernanda Chavarri traveled to Waddell, Arizona, to find out how citrus grower Dwayne Justice is part of a growing local food economy.
The constant sound of traffic and airplanes going by juxtaposes with the sound of birds, barking dogs, and a tractor as Justice picks oranges by hand. Justice is a longtime citrus farmer. He grows ruby red grapefruit, Valencia oranges, navel oranges, Mineola tangelos, and lemons on his farm.
My family started this property about a little over 80 years ago, so we've been on it all that time. And the first citrus was probably planted about 70 years ago. I don't know for sure, but I have a few old white grapefruit trees that are at least 70 years old that are still alive.
A lot has changed since the days in the mid-1950s when the first major crop was planted in his farm.
Maricopa County has lost a large portion of their citrus business to the economy and also the crazy building that went on for a number of years up here that took a lot of that citrus out for planting houses.
Justice says today there isn't much citrus left in the valley.
There's some spots over in the Mesa area that still has quite a bit, and some of the Indian reservations have quite a bit of citrus now. And the rest of it's all down in the Yuma area. It's a very challenging market. Now, my citrus is all organic, and so it's certified organic and sold as such. Most of the commercial groves out here have taken everything out because they simply couldn't make any money on it.
Kevin Rogers is the president of the Arizona Farm Bureau. He says citrus farmers in Arizona today have to focus on special niches like Justice's organic fruits in order to stay afloat.
They're there and surviving, and even though the numbers are decreased a little bit overall as far as acres of production, they're still going to continue to find that niche market to survive in this economy. People would rather, you know, purchase locally. They'd rather go to the citrus farm here in Mesa or in Yuma or someplace and buy the crop and actually get to meet the farmer that cultivated and fertilized it and took care of it and harvested it.
That's why Justice is selling to small cooperatives, farmers markets, and community-supported agriculture groups on top of the product he sends to a Rio Rico packing house. From that packing house, Justice's citrus, primarily grapefruit, is shipped around the state to grocery stores like Sprouts and Whole Foods, and some of it goes nationwide. In Yuma, lemons are the leading crop. Roger says Arizona brings in about $40 million from lemons, making it the number two producer of lemons in the country.
During this time of year, they're loading 747s with lemons and sending them to Japan.
Other citrus products like oranges are not as profitable anymore. California and Florida have always been competitors in the citrus supply, but Arizona's biggest competition comes from foreign countries. Justice says in recent years, the Arizona citrus economy has been hit the hardest by Brazil and Mexico, where they ship more citrus because labor and quality inspections are cheaper than in the U.S. The citrus at Justice's farm is picked by hand, and most of the time ends up on somebody's kitchen table within days of being picked. But even with an increased interest in organic and locally grown products, Justice says the market is nowhere near where it was before.
It is not as good a program as it was 30, 40 years ago. Citrus at that time was a very, very productive crop, and you did make very good money on it.
He says most of the time, the money he makes is to cover the costs of production and labor. So why do this for a living?
Yeah, you do it because you like the fact that you're creating something. And that's the product of your toil. This kind of operation it becomes a part of you. It's in your blood.
That's Dwayne Justice of Waddell, Arizona, telling reporter Fernanda Echavarri that he's found new ways to compete in the ancient vocation of tending to citrus groves. This is the 5 C's, A Century Later, an Arizona Public Media special report. Climate. It's probably the hardest of Arizona's economic 5 C's to define. Arizona's climate became a selling point in the Roaring Twenties. That's when people stricken with lung ailments like tuberculosis started moving here for the warm, dry air. And then came suburban development and air conditioning and swimming pools. Soon, millions of residents of frigid places like Minnesota and Pennsylvania were moving here in droves. They also started vacationing here. Historian Tom Sheridan says one place in particular opened up Arizona's tourism industry, the Grand Canyon, and it was the Santa Fe Railroad that figured out that people would pay to travel to see it.
Once it discovered that people would come to Arizona for reasons other than cotton, copper, or cattle, the Grand Canyon became one of the major tourism destination spots of the United States and probably in the world.
Robert Rappaport talked to state tourism officials recently about Arizona's climate, but he also finds a few dark clouds in our otherwise sunny skies.
Arizona is in high tourism season right now, and that means plenty of winter visitors and a lot of events that draw locals and out-of-towners. The Arizona Office of Tourism says nearly 37 million domestic and international tourists visited the state in 2010, pumping about $48 million a day into Arizona's economy. While there's no specific data that says definitively that those visitors came here because of the climate, Arizona bases much of its tourism marketing on nice weather and outdoor adventures. Locally, the Metropolitan Tucson Convention and Visitors Bureau does do some tracking as to why visitors come to our city. Marketing Director Allison Cooper says website studies and other research ask people why they visit Tucson, and many of those taking part in the surveys say climate is the main reason.
It is a key driver. We are marketing a message of our spectacular outdoor and that we are truly the real Southwest into cities such as Chicago and Denver. So while they're shoveling snow, we're marketing and shoveling sunshine and mild climate and everything that you can do in our spectacular outdoors that's so different from what they have to offer and where they live.
Cooper says Tucson and Southern Arizona typically welcome approximately 6.8 million visitors a year, who spend about $2.6 billion during their stays. I recently found a couple of winter residents downtown at the visitor center.
We like to come because it's warm. I have arthritis, so it feels really good to have the warm weather.
That's Evelyn Myron, who visits Tucson every year from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. She and her husband Joe Myron live in the city of Menominee.
We come here to escape the winters. When we coming down here, there's a snowstorm to keep us coming. Couldn't wait to get here because of the terrible weather that we were traveling through. So when we got here, it was just like paradise. It's just beautiful weather, and what else could you ask for?
While the number of visitors to Arizona decreased a few years ago as the economy soured, climate change could have longer-term effects on tourism.
And we're clearly getting warmer. What kind of temperatures are visitors willing to put up with?
Dr. Jonathan Overpeck is the co-director of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment and a professor of geosciences and atmospheric sciences. He says Arizona has been in a severe drought since 1999 without much relief in sight. Add that to extreme heat, wildfires, and bark beetle infestation, and Overpeck says the visitor experience is bound to change.
Well, it gets a little tricky if people are planning their big vacation in the fire season. You know, it's going to be smokier. And places they might really cherish with nice, beautiful pine forests and things will be burned forests, and they're often not viewed as recreationally exciting. In the future, if our water infrastructure is taxed, as it probably will be, you know, there'll be more drought restrictions, and that's got to affect tourism.
Nancy Sellover is the keeper of all of Arizona's weather statistics. As the state climatologist, she sees firsthand how climate affects many things in Arizona.
It certainly affects tourism, it affects agriculture, it affects ranching. And so when we have things like drought, that also impacts all those things. It certainly impacts our water resources, which are already tend to be relatively scarce because we live in a desert climate.
Aside from tourism, Sellover says climate is a big economic driver for Arizona in another sense, research dollars. She says much of what is learned at the state's three universities and other places can be relevant in other desert areas around the world, particularly in the Middle East.
That's Robert Rappaport, and I'm Mark Dugan. You're listening to The Five C's, A Century Later, an Arizona Public Media special report. Arizona is ground zero for North American copper mining. For more than 100 years, both independent prospectors and multinational corporations have staked their claims to copper veins here. Some towns that formed around the earliest mines continue to function today. Others dried up as the mines went bust. But copper is currently riding a sustained boom. Prices are up to record levels. Mining companies are stepping up production at existing mines and scouting around to dig new ones. Some Arizona mines are routinely cited for pollution and safety violations, and more of the company's expansion plans are being opposed by the public.
I think there's going to be a tipping point. I think at some point people will realize that environmental protection doesn't cost, it pays.
That's Roger Featherstone, director of the Arizona Mining Reform Coalition. Sounds like these have been ringing off the slopes of Arizona mountains for over 100 years. Wait a minute, actually, it started out just a little quieter. But the arrival of the railroad changed everything. Now it was easy to ship the copper to market. By the early part of the 20th century, there were active mines in Ajo, Bisbee, Globe, and Morenci, among other places. In Arizona, the copper boom was on. When the state became the nation's 48th in 1912, it led in copper production. It also became a laboratory for a new method of mining, the open pit. Well, it proved to be perfect for getting at the state's copper deposits. And by the 1930s, underground mines were going extinct, replaced by the gaping V-shaped holes of open pit copper mining.
While I worked like a slave in that open pit mine.
Since then, the copper market has gone boom and bust many times. Mines have opened and closed. Companies have made fortunes, gone bankrupt, and merged into others. And through it all, the worldwide demand for copper has exploded. Our modern age essentially runs on copper. Your home or apartment has hundreds of pounds of it. There's another 50 pounds or so of it in your vehicle. People have been using copper for 11,000 years, and we've been pulling it out of the earth for at least 7,000 years.
Copper can
chemical symbol Cu. Melting point, 1,984 degrees Fahrenheit. Boiling point, 4,600 degrees Fahrenheit.
Copper is non-magnetic. It conducts electricity and heat. It is easy to shape, bend, and form. Copper can be recycled over and over without any effect on its properties. About 80% of the copper humanity has produced is still in use today.
That's why some refer to copper as the miracle metal. And it's why copper was essentially the first of Arizona's five C's. But is it still an anchor of the state's economy?
I would say it would be the top. I firmly am convinced that copper is what drives Arizona.
William Escarza is an historian who studied Arizona's mining history at length.
I mean, it's a very important industry, and it certainly employs many people throughout the state.
The five C's ceased to exist a few years ago.
And Marshall Vest is an economist with the University of Arizona.
Take copper mining, for instance. It used to comprise 4 to 5% of the labor force. Now it's 0.1%. It's very, very small. The composition of Arizona's economy today, it's quite diversified.
But many Arizona politicians continue to focus on a resource-based economy. They frequently tout copper mines as the key to creating more skilled, high-paying jobs. Meanwhile, proponents of the tourism industry say copper, Arizona's first C, is threatening climate, which is sometimes called the fifth C. They worry that allowing more mines, especially on public lands, will drive tourists away. Arizona became the nation's 48th state 100 years ago. It entered the Union at a time when the American frontier was rapidly disappearing and giving way to a new urban and industrial age. But Arizona was a defiant holdout. It continued to rely on just five core areas of commerce and also remained mostly rural. Then about 60 years ago, explosive growth transformed Arizona. Today, at 100 years old, it's an urban state where most of the population lives in cities or along the interstates. And Arizona's economy is now very diversified. Chalk it up to all those newcomers who moved here for the sunshine. They brought with them many different ideas and cultures and skills, and they turned Arizona into something new, a thriving state in the sun, reliant on so much more than just the five C's. You've been listening to The Five C's, A Century Later, an Arizona Public Media Special Centennial Report. There's much more on our website. Just look for the Five C's logo at azpublicmedia.org. The Five C's, A Century Later, was written and produced by Mark Dugan, with production contributions from Robert Rappaport, Steve Shadley, and Fernanda Echavarri. Peter Michaels was the executive producer. I'm Mark Dugan, and this is Arizona Public Media News.